Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Putin accuses U.S. of trying to dominate international relations, but says Russia is still always open to cooperation. He spoke Thursday in an annual live question and answer session on Russian television, in which he took questions from members of the Russian public. Mr. Putin defended his decision to clear the way for the possible sale of an S-300 air defense system to Tehran, saying it was a result of Iran's willingness to try to reach a settlement over its nuclear program. Moscow signed an $800 million contract in 2007 to supply Tehran with S-300 batteries, but it froze the contract 3 years later after the UN Security Council imposed sanctions on Iran. Thousands of people marched through the South African city of Durban on Thursday to protest recent anti-immigrant violence that has left five people dead and thousands displaced. Around 4,000 people marched through Durban, chanting "Down with Xenophobia" and "A United Africa" at an event attended by residents, students, and local religious and political leaders. In a suburb of Johannesburg, police fired rubber bullets and tear gas on Thursday to disperse a crowd of anti-immigrant protesters trying to attack foreign-owned shops. The violent attacks in South Africa first targeted shops owned by foreign nationals, mainly from Somalia and Ethiopia. The attacks have since spread to all African foreigners, leaving many feeling terrified and hopeless. The violence has forced many families to flee to makeshift camps, protected by armed guards. This is VOA News. Islamic State militants pounded the Iraqi government's security compound in the center of Anbar province capital, Ramadi, Thursday as the governor calls for reinforcements and arms. Iraqi media report that government forces have lost part of Iraq's largest oil refinery in the town of Beji in north of Baghdad. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Islamic State militants mounted waves of attacks on Ramadi's heavily fortified security zone overnight and into the day Thursday, using suicide car bombs against defenders of the city center. Anbar Council member Salah Fehdawi warned that Ramadi was in danger of falling. Provincial Governor Suhaib Rawi also pleaded with both the Iraqi government and neighboring states to help prevent Anbar province from falling into the hands of Islamic State militants. Edward Uranian, Cairo.
Al-Qaeda militants have taken control of a major airport in Yemen's southern city of Muqala, where the militants have made big gains earlier this month. Officials say the Al-Qaeda fighters faced little resistance from the military Thursday in Muqala, a port city in the capital of Yemen's largest province. A major oil terminal in southern Yemen also fell under the control of militants. Earlier this month, Al-Qaeda fighters captured a Yemeni military camp in Muqala. They also stormed a prison in the city, freeing close to 300 prisoners. Negotiators from Iran and a group of world powers will hold their next round of talks on Iran's nuclear program next week in Vienna. The European Union announced the April 22nd, 23rd talks Thursday. The two sides will be working on taking the framework agreement they crafted earlier this month and turning it into a final deal by their self-imposed June 30th deadline. The group includes Britain, China, France, Russia, the United States, and Germany. They want Iran to curb its nuclear activity to ensure it is not building nuclear weapons in exchange for lifting sanctions that have hurt the Iranian economy. Prominent Ukrainian journalist has been shot dead on the street, said Ukrainian officials Thursday. Ukraine's Interior Ministry said in an online statement that Oles Bruzina, chief editor of the newspaper Today, was shot near his home in Kiev. Reports said the journalist was killed by two masked gunmen who fled in a car. Police are investigating. And authorities leading the multinational hunt for the missing Malaysian jetliner say they are prepared to double the current search zone in the Indian Ocean if nothing is found soon. At a news conference, Malaysian officials said 61% of the original 60,000 square kilometer search zone has been scoured with no signs of the plane. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The violent xenophobic attacks have erupted in South Africa, leaving 5 dead and thousands displaced. The violence first targeted shops owned by foreign nationals, largely from Somalia and Ethiopia. Now it's spreading against all African foreigners, leaving many feeling terrified and hopeless.
That's Tuso Kamala reporting from Johannesburg. We'll have the latest developments on this story coming up. Also, the outgoing administration of Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says it continues to hold out hope of finding the more than 200 schoolgirls abducted from Chibok a year ago. Libya's government jets bombed parts of the capital, Tripoli, as militias and two warring political factions reopened peace talks in Morocco today. And a young Kenyan activist is part of a fast-moving, low-cost movement that successfully tackles the impacts of global warming at the local level. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, South African police say about 50 immigrants fearing anti-foreign mobs took refuge last night in a Johannesburg police station. Mobs have been attacking and looting shops in Durban run by foreigners. An aid organization says 2,000 people have sought refuge in sports fields in Durban, which has been the center of the violence. Also, thousands of people were gathering today in Durban to protest the violence. The xenophobic attacks in South Africa have left 5 dead and thousands displaced. The violence first targeted shops owned by foreign nationals, largely from Somalia and Ethiopia. Now it's spreading against all African foreigners, leaving many feeling terrified and hopeless. Tuso Kamala reports from Johannesburg.
Somali national Ibrahim Mohamed Ali runs a coffee shop in Johannesburg. Memories of the 2008 xenophobic attacks in South Africa are still fresh in his mind. He lost his panel beating business and his brother as well.
That time, even my brother, there, you kill him, that xenophobic guys. My brother is passed away there. We'll kill him and that robbery for xenophobia. Me, I lost all my tools, all my money.
7 years later, the attacks have erupted again and have left foreigners terrified. Somali and Ethiopian nationals owning grocery shops in Soweto Township were the first to be targeted. They were beaten and chased away by locals who took over their businesses. Foreign shop owners in Durban were the next to be targeted, and now all African foreign nationals are being told to pack and leave. Thousands have been displaced and are living in makeshift camps. Ethiopian national Sarah Kitane is traumatized after being violently forced out of her shop in Soweto.
I'm not feeling okay. I was losing 2 months. I was losing my life. Then I don't know what can I say. But I don't have any choice now. I don't know. I don't have any choice now. I'll go back there. But the people is not gone. They will start again.
Other victims say South African police are turning a blind eye to their fate. Kitau Anio, 32, is one of them.
I did go to report for police. No one helped me that time. I was in police station. No police even that time. I don't know what happened. I didn't receive anything.
Many others, like 25-year-old John Alem, say they are puzzled by the attacks.
Yeah, we are African brothers, but they give us big problem. Yeah, they kill our brothers, and they rob our own shops.
South African authorities have denied the country is experiencing xenophobic attacks, preferring to call them criminal acts. Abdirikaz Ali Osman, National Secretary of the Somali Community Board of South Africa, disagrees.
To me, actually, it's pure xenophobic attacks which have been targeted by the foreign nationals who are living in the country, especially those who are having small informal businesses in the townships and informal settlements. So It's obvious that it is xenophobic and Afrophobic violence, actually.
Osman is pleading with authorities to swiftly intervene before these foreign nationals, who have already lost their livelihood, lose their lives as well. Although the attacks are intensifying each day, the foreign nationals, especially those from Somalia and Ethiopia, say they would rather die in South Africa than return to their countries of origin, where they are likely to be met with even more violence. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Liberia, auditors are questioning how the Ministry of Defense spent almost $700,000 on the fight against Ebola. The General Auditing Commission published a report today asking for receipts to prove where the money went. The Defense Ministry says the money was used for fuel, staff allowances, communications, and training. The ministry admitted procedural errors but denied any misappropriation of funds. The audit also accuses the Liberian National Police of paying 68 officers, even though they were not in their assigned areas during the Ebola crisis. The police say the officers were working on covert operations to stop the spread of the virus. Liberia has had no new infections for 20 days. If no new cases are found for another 22, the World Health Organization says the nation can be declared Ebola-free. Infections in Sierra Leone have gradually declined to 9 in the past week, but Guinea is struggling with fluctuating numbers in Conakry and coastal areas. Guinea discovered 28 new infections in the last week, and some could not be traced to any person infected with Ebola. The three countries lost more than 10,500 lives to Ebola in the past year. There are reports today of another boat tragedy involving migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean from Libya to Europe. Media reports say more than 40 people drowned after their small inflatable boat sank. The accident comes just days after 400 migrants lost their lives when their boat sank. The World Bank Group and the International Monetary Fund are holding their annual spring meetings here in Washington. Bank President Jim Yong Kim held an opening press conference today. He says during the meetings, the bank will focus intensely on the goal of ending extreme poverty by 2030.
The world has had great success in the last 25 years in lifting people out of poverty, an astounding two-thirds reduction in the percentage. Today, fewer than 1 billion people live in extreme poverty, and we must now re-examine our strategies to lift the final billion out of poverty and into the modern world.
He says the World Bank has used three broad approaches to ending poverty over the last 50 years. He says those approaches will be used as a framework for advising countries in the future.
First, we must promote strong economic growth. Second, countries must invest in people, especially in education and health. And third, countries must build social safety nets and protections against both natural disasters and pandemics to ensure that people don't remain trapped in extreme poverty.
Kim also spoke about economic growth and whether developing countries are reaping any benefits.
Global growth is expected to be around 3% this year, just as we forecast in January. But prospects for developing countries continue to be downgraded from 4.8% in January to an estimated 4.5% now. For developing countries, this marks a further slowdown from 2014 and the fourth consecutive year of falling growth rates, which had averaged 6% from 2000 to 2011. The World Bank Group's work is focused on improving economic growth in developing countries in order to end extreme poverty and boost shared prosperity. We see two major transitions for developing countries in the coming months: adjustment to lower oil prices and the prospect of tightening global financing conditions. Our main piece of advice for developing countries is that they should undertake comprehensive structural reforms to promote growth. Structural reforms raise productivity and growth over time to sustain rising prosperity. Some reforms also support domestic demand in the near term. An ambitious reform plan signaled to investors that governments are proactive about improving long-term prospects. This boosts confidence and often translates into larger capital inflows and lower borrowing costs.
He says India, China, Mexico, and Rwanda are among the countries that have undertaken such reforms.
There's no single blueprint for structural reforms, but broadly we see several drivers of economic growth in the future. First, a reorienting of growth. Whether it be away from consumption and toward investment in Turkey or Brazil, to the opposite in China, away from investment and toward consumption. Second, addressing infrastructure needs, especially in energy and transportation. Third, improving expenditures on education and healthcare and reforming labor markets. Fourth, reducing barriers to trade and facilitating regional integration. And finally, reforming energy subsidies.
The World Bank president also addressed the issue of falling oil prices and their effects on developing countries. He describes the situation as mixed.
Lower oil prices will help reduce poverty for many, but they'll also have negative effects for some. One benefit is that more than 70% of the world's poor live in oil-importing countries, and the lower prices will have a positive impact on growth, which will raise incomes. And two, the majority of poor households in low-income countries are net food buyers and will benefit from lower food prices. However, lower oil prices will also hurt some of the very poorest, who tend to be net food sellers. Falling food prices will reduce their incomes. About 70% of the world's extreme poor live in rural villages and work as farmers or in informal jobs. We must promote growth in agriculture by giving farmers more control over how and what they produce, and by improving their access to better seeds, water, electricity, and markets.
That's World Bank President Jim Yong Kim speaking at the spring meetings of the World Bank Group and International Monetary Fund in Washington. Seventeen minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The outgoing administration of Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says it continues to hold out hope of finding the more than 200 schoolgirls abducted from Chibok a year ago. Meanwhile, the Nigerian military says it is closing in on a Boko Haram stronghold in the Sabisa forest where the girls were first held captive by the rebels. Mike O'Meary of the National Information Center says intelligence reports indicate the girls are still being held there. However, many parents and community leaders in Chibok dismiss the president's effort as political grandstanding. They say their children are long gone from the Sambisa forest. A community leader says some were once sighted in the Alagarno forest, but Nigeria's military says it found no sign of the girls there. A Boko Haram leader initially said they would be married to members of the terrorist group. Others believe many were taken to Cameroon or killed. Well, canine rabies kills tens of thousands of people every year and costs economies billions of dollars. A new global study says understanding the true burden of the disease may result in more resources to prevent it. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Dr. Louise Taylor says while the tools exist to prevent deaths from rabies, they're not being used in many countries hardest hit by the disease.
At the moment, our best estimate from this recent study is that about 59,000 people across the world are dying of rabies every year. And that's just the burden from canine rabies transmitted by dogs.
Taylor's with the Global Alliance for Rabies Control. She's coordinator of the Partners for Rabies Prevention Group.
So aside from the deaths that we have, we have problems with the income that those people could have generated, and so there's a wider societal cost that's impacting heavily on developing countries particularly. And then there's all the costs in terms of the control efforts that are being put in. So although control efforts are not adequate to prevent all the deaths, they are preventing a large number of deaths. So when we add up all those costs together, this recent study has basically come out and said a total cost of about $8.6 billion to the global economy every year.
Rabies is spread mostly by dogs, even though it exists in many bats. Men and boys generally receive more bites from infected dogs than women and girls.
It does tend to affect children slightly disproportionately, and the WHO estimates probably about 40 to 60% of the victims are children under the age of about 16. And that comes about because, with it being transmitted by dogs, children tend to be attracted towards dogs, and they may not understand exactly how to behave around a dog. They may provoke the dog a little bit more than maybe an adult would. And so they tend to both be affected more by dog bites and also by more severe dog bites.
Africa, Asia, and Latin America are regions where rabies is endemic. While vaccinating dogs is routine in the U.S. and other developed countries, that's not the case in many developing nations. It costs between $1 and $5 to vaccinate a dog if done on a massive scale, like in the United States. But Taylor says that can be a financial hardship for a poor family.
In the developing world, the infrastructure of the veterinary systems and also the health systems is just much less developed. And there are just not wide-scale distribution networks for vaccination. We're also looking at a population that is really at the poor end of the spectrum, and so those people do not necessarily have the money available to vaccinate their dogs. And there's also an awareness issue as well, that we need to build awareness that this can be prevented.
Dr. Taylor describes the study's findings as a current situation report of global rabies control.
These countries have many other health priorities. It's a very difficult balance. And what we've found is that canine rabies just doesn't seem to get the attention that it really should have amongst these other competing health priorities.
In fact, the World Health Organization has classified canine rabies as a neglected tropical disease. Taylor would like rabies to be among health priorities included in the new Sustainable Development Goals later this year. Because so many dogs are not vaccinated, large numbers of people must be treated after they are bitten. They must receive a series of injections to prevent the nearly always fatal disease. For example, Taylor says, in Asia, 26 million people receive post-exposure treatment every year. 15 million of them are in China. But in Africa, many people bitten by a rabid dog have no access to life-saving treatment. Prevention, she says, is the easiest way to save lives, both animal and human. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 23 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Thousands of people marched through Durban today to protest recent anti-immigrant violence that has left five people dead and thousands displaced. The outgoing administration of Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says it continues to hold out hope of finding the more than 200 schoolgirls abducted from the Chibok a year ago. And Libyan government jets bomb parts of the capital, Tripoli, as militias and two warring political factions reopened peace talks in Morocco today. And for more news and the latest updates, visit our website at www.voanews.com. Well, a young Kenyan activist is part of a rapidly growing low-cost movement that successfully tackles the impacts of global warming at the local level. Winnie Asiti sits on a board of young climate leaders that distributes small-scale grants to young, marginalized climate activists in global warming hotspots from the Philippines to Iraq. In its first 2 years, Global Green Grants Next Generation Climate Board contributed $110,000 in 24 grants to 23 groups in 17 countries. I spoke with the rising star of the next generation of environmental leaders on what inspired her.
I drew my inspiration from a lot of things, and I joined the University Environmental Club at university, so through that I got to interact with other like-minded young people working on environmental issues, well, a lot of environmental issues and not just climate change. And then in the year 2006, these climate change negotiations were being hosted by Kenya, and we all got an opportunity as university students to go to the meetings as volunteers and also as observers. So we got interest in climate change negotiations and climate change work, met a lot of people who had similar interests, met a lot of youth from elsewhere outside of Kenya who also had an interest in this. And that's also around the time the African Youth Initiative on Climate Change was established. And I got actively engaged in that. So that's where it all started.
What role would you say that women play as climate activists?
I think women as climate activists really play different roles depending on context, depending on geographies. I mean, their location that comes in really bring out the different contexts and the different ways and roles that women actually play. But I think a lot of women activists bring to the climate change debate the whole aspect of the human impacts of climate change. So I think for me that's quite profound because women are able to relate with some of these things, especially those who are coming from communities or countries where climate change effects, such as drought, for example, in Kenya, floods, the coastal areas rising and all of that. So they're able to bring these stories and link them to their communities, their children, basically how the impacts are affecting them.
What are some of the major projects that you are working on right now?
Some of the major projects we are working on as the Next Generation Climate Board is we are looking at how to engage young people in the COP process. COP21 is upcoming in Paris towards the end of the year, and we thought it would be quite helpful and interesting to get young people engaged in this and to support their activities. So we are looking at supporting young people to carry out activities that are related and have an impact on the climate change negotiations that are going to take place in Paris. Those activities could be anywhere at the local level, at the national level, or at the international level. We are also looking to bring some youth to the COP in Paris at the end of the year so that they can be able to come with voices from their communities which are impacted with climate change in one way or another, so they can be able to add their voice to the whole sea of humanity that will be at the COP, hopefully try to influence the process as much as possible. We are also looking at engaging with young people in terms of communication to get out their stories about how they are addressing issues of climate change in their communities. So what adaptation measures are they putting in place? Are they educating themselves? Are they learning from the elders, for example, about how communities were able to adapt to climate change? Because you have a lot of local and indigenous knowledge that really the youth should be looking up to as a way of adapting or trying to live with climate change impacts in their own communities.
As a young trailblazer, where do you see yourself in the next few years?
I see myself playing different roles, actually more interested in research and policy issues. So working to strengthen, especially the issue of making sure that a lot of policy is informed by research. And it's not just in the climate change sector, you find that a lot of policies, I'm sure the text that comes out of Paris won't be very much informed by the IPCC report, which is really science. So that's the research. So trying to make sure that, especially at local and national level, that we are integrating as much research evidence, as much real like research and real statistics and real scientific concerns into our policies, so that at the end of the day, we have policies that work. That's where I see myself.
That was Winnie Asiti, board member of the Global Green Grants Next Generation Climate Board. She spoke with me from Baltimore, Maryland. This is African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali goes in-depth with the Sierra Leonean president, Ernest Bai Koroma. That's next, right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Thousands of people marched through Durban today to protest recent anti-immigration violence that has left five people dead and thousands displaced. Libyan government jets bomb parts of the capital Tripoli as militias and two warring political factions reopened peace talks in Morocco today. And a young Kenyan activist is part of a fast-moving, low-cost movement that successfully tackles the impacts of global warming at the local level. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, music from Cameroon and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand your opening move is Uganda chess.
Yes, Kim, we're going to begin in Uganda, where the Disney movie production of The Queen of Katwe about young chess prodigy Fiona Mutesi has sparked new interest in the game. Now children from around the country are taking up chess like never before. Reporter Elizabeth Pola has more for VOA from Kampala.
Enthusiasm for chess has been on the rise in Uganda ever since Disney started filming The Queen of Katwe. The movie follows the life of Fiona Mutesi, who made it from the slums to become one of Uganda's best and youngest chess players. This publicity has had a noted impact on Uganda's chess federation, as enrollment has doubled in recent months. Once a game played primarily in cities, chess has expanded its reach, with children in rural communities becoming interested in the game. Unable to afford their own chess boards, kids will often create their own set out of soap figurines or bottle caps and play against their classmates. Caxton Rogers Kalule, the publicity specialist for the Ugandan Chess Federation, has been playing the game for 17 years. He now finds himself traveling across the country teaching chess to youths. However, he says, chess is more than just a simple board game. Rather, it teaches people how to think, focus, and understand strategy. For this reason, one of the Federation's many focuses are vulnerable kids.
In the not too near future, we want to be like chess, like being played like in every district across the country, especially in these densely populated slum areas. Because we discovered that chess, we can use chess like put kids out of the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? For example, even Mutesi was among the kids who were on the street, but it was because of chess we had managed to put them together in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that they even started getting interested in going back to school other than going on the street and pickpocketing, those kind of things. Then, with time, we really hope that we shall have a very, very positive impact on the society around the country.
It's also a unifying game, as players do not need to share the same culture, gender, or even language to enjoy playing together. Matthew Sanko, one of the newest members of the Ugandan national team, says chess expands into every reach of his life, helping him decide on everything from business to marriage.
It's a romantic game. I attach everything to it. I take it like a business. I take it like a movie. I can lift it and put it in every aspect of life. Chess affects my lifestyle. It affects my dress code. It affects my music. In business, I can say, now my king, it's me. I'm the managing director. My queen, you know, I can have managers. Down here, there's major pieces. I can have casual laborers. Or I can make it a war tactic.
The U.S. Embassy in Kampala has also put together a beginner's team and received a massive outpouring of interest from the community. However, funding for chess programs still remains a challenge in Uganda. Airline tickets to Olympiads or championships must be donated, and many players end up spending their own money to compete internationally. Yet for chess lovers in Uganda, cost comes secondary to their love of the game. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports from Johannesburg is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
In African club football, David, fans across the continent looking forward to another round in the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup tournaments. We've reached the last 16 stage in both competitions. Let's begin with the Champions League, David. And how about the fixtures?
Right, Sonny, we've got USM Alger of Algeria against Kaloum of Guinea. I'm tipping USM Alger to win that first leg and also to win the tie. Sanga Belendi of DR Congo against Al Hilal of Sudan. Sanga have been one of the surprise packets. They beat teams from Angola, and then they beat Cotton Sport of Cameroon, who've been doing well in recent years. And I actually give them the edge over Hilal, although Hilal definitely have got a lot more experience. These are good times, in fact, for the DR Congo, Sonny. All four clubs from that country are still in contention, two in the Champions League and two others in the Confederations Cup. Sudan have two teams in the Champions League. Their other team, El Merrekh, are at home to Esperance of Tunisia. I feel this is going to be more bad news for the Sudanese because Esperance, to me, are a side that traditionally get at least to the group stage, and they do look to me stronger over two legs than El Merrekh. Then you've got El Ulma of Algeria against CS Sfaxien of Tunisia. And there's a lot of North African teams, as you'll notice, in this last 16 stage. El Ulma have scraped through their match against Ashanti Kotoko. Sfaxien, on the other hand, were very impressive when they hammered Samassi Sokoto 5-0 in Togo in the first leg. And I give CS Sfaxien a good chance, Sonny, of getting through to the group stage. AC Leopards of Congo-Brazzaville against Smouha of Egypt. Now, Smouha are new kids on the block. When you think of Egypt and you think of the Champions League, it's normally Al Ahly and Zamalek. And no surprise, Ahly have won it a record 8 times and Zamalek have won it 5 times. But this time Zamalek didn't make it, and this team, Smouha, from Alexandria, the port city in the north of the country, they've already knocked out Enyimba of Nigeria, so they've got good credentials. AC Leopards, they've been doing well in Africa in recent years. And this one, Sonny, is a difficult one to call. But I'm going to go perhaps against the tide slightly here and go with Smouha. Next up would be Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco against Al Ahly. Another tricky one, Sonny. I'll go with Al Ahly to scrape through. Yet another big tie is Raja Casablanca of Morocco against Anton Setif of Algeria, who are the defending champions. In the previous round, Raja eliminated Kaiser Chiefs of South Africa. And boy, did they get good support in Casablanca in the return match. A crowd of up to 70,000 packed into the Stade Mohammed V to roar on the team known as the Green Devils. Well-organized side, and they've got some sharp finishers in their team. Setif had a pretty comfortable victory over Real Banjul of the Gambia. Tough one this, Sonny, really tough one. I'm going to go with Raja to edge the Setif side out of the competition. And then finally, Stade Malien of Mali against TP Mazembe of the DR Congo. Mazembe, 4 times African champions, and I feel that they will be slight favourites to win that tie. The first leg is on April 17, 18 and 19, and the return match is on May 1, 2 and 3. And a reminder to our listeners that the winners qualify group stages where the 8 clubs will be split into 2 groups of 4. But it's not all over for the losers. They will go into the playoffs in the CAF Confederations Cup against the CAF Confederation Cup last 16 winners. So the winners go into the group stages and the losers down to the CAF Confederation Cup.
And speaking of the CAF Confederation Cup, David, how about a preview of the last 16 in that tournament?
Right, Sonny, you've got Ons Creatures of Mali. That's 11 creators. I've had 4, 5 emails recently about a team from Mali who are competing in Africa for the first time. So they're a creative bunch, these guys. And they're up against the far more experienced ASEC Mimosas of Ivory Coast, who will be favorites to win that tie. In another West African showdown, you've got Djoliba of Mali against Hearts of Oak of Ghana. Hearts of Oak were under a lot of fire within Ghana before the CAF Confederation got kicked off. Former stars of the club and also the national team said that Hearts lacked quality and their competing in Africa was a waste of money. Well, Hearts have silenced their critics. They had home and away wins in the previous round over in Gore of Senegal. And they'll put up a good fight, I believe, against Djoliba of Mali. And this one's tough to call. But given the fact that Hearts have won three matches and drawn one, and they're proving to be not such a waste of money after all, I'm going to give them slight edge there. CAF Algeria play Club Africain of Tunisia in an all-North African tie. Club Africain have not actually kicked the ball yet in the competition, although we've had two rounds. They had a bye in the first round, and then Dolphins of Nigeria arrived late in Tunisia and were disqualified. So we don't really know the form of Club Africain at this stage, but I would make them favorite. Warring Wolves of Nigeria, they're at home to the free-scoring Etan Chieti from DR Congo. Now, the Congolese hit Asli Shendi of Sudan for five in Kinshasa in the previous round. So they're coming with some good form, but nevertheless, I think the Wolves can win this tie over two matches. A famous name, Zamalek of Egypt, up against Fuz Rabat of Morocco. Fuz, previous winners of the Confederation Cup. Zamalek competing in the Confederation Cup for the first time, and they get my tip to advance from that North African derby. Munana of Gabon take on Orlando Pirates of South Africa. Munana are the top scorers so far in the Confederation Cup. They've banged in 12 goals in four matches, an average of three a game. But they're up against by far their toughest opposition so far in Orlando Pirates, former African champions. And I would make the Soweto Buccaneers slight favorites to advance. Young Africans of Tanzania, the only East African side left in the competition. They're up against the 12 Sahel of Tunisia, another former winner of the Confederation Cup. And when East and North clash, Sonny, it does tend to go in favor of the North. And finally, you've got my heroes, I guess, at this stage of the competition. Royal Leopard, that's the police team from Swaziland. They're up against V-Club from the Democratic Republic of Congo. This one looks like a bit of a mismatch. V-Club last year reached the final of the Champions League and were beaten only on the away goal rule by Anton Sertif. Royal Leopard, on the other hand, are trying to create history and become the first club from Swaziland to make the playoffs of the CAF Confederation Cup. Sadly, I think the Congolese will emerge victorious. Same date, Sonny, as the Champions League. First legs, April 17, 18 and 19. Return matches, May 1, 2 and 3. The losers are eliminated from the competition, and then the winners will play the losers of the Champions League last 16 ties.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, a South Sudanese agriculture expert says the country needs a combined effort to combat food insecurity, and money transfer companies that were shut down by Kenyan authorities will go to court to force the government to reverse its decision. First, some music. Here's Frida Ingu of Cameroon with You Are My Everlasting Love. With You Are My Everlasting Love. Well, a South Sudanese agriculture expert says the country needs a combined effort to combat food insecurity threatening families living in areas hard hit by the conflict. Sylvester Okaka says South Sudan's research institutions should share knowledge with other institutions in Africa to help local farmers use modern farming techniques. He tells reporter John Tanza that the task of providing enough food for every family in South Sudan is not easy.
Water resources, Minister of Agriculture, Minister of Industry, and all the universities, they come together. Minister of Roads, because you need a feeder road. A farmer sitting down in Maridi will not produce enough because he knows there is no road to Juba. So nowadays, you bring all the stakeholders, including farmers, to identify the problem and to come up with a solution. So those are things that our people can do. We have a lot of people who are qualified to do so.
Are there institutions in the country run by the Ministry of Agriculture or international aid agencies that help farmers identify new ways of producing food?
Yeah, there are institutions within the Ministry of Agriculture that is research unit, which is supposed to be semi-autonomous agriculture research. Once it is semi-autonomous, it will have that power to engage other research institutions within the neighboring countries and overseas to interact positively and copy the technologies.
What is your prescription for this problem?
The Mobutu Protocol, that states that all African countries, the government, they need to put at least 10% of their annual budget into agriculture. Most of the countries have done that, with a few exceptions. But the countries like Tanzania, Uganda, Ghana, they put some money into agriculture.
But every time when there is a big occasion in South Sudan, President Salva Kiir has been on record saying they want to use the money of the petroleum to fuel agriculture. How do we explain that statement which he has been making?
We thank our President Salva Kiir for giving value to agriculture and mentioning in every occasion. But the truth of the matter is that how much is that much, and how real is the claim of putting agriculture as a priority? For example, in Ghana, the government subsidized the price of seed. The official price of seed of maize in the market from the seed company is 4 CD. The government subsidizes and every farmer buys it at 2 CD, which is half. That is a contribution of the government. And the government builds what they call national storage, because most of the farmers, they don't have a good place to store their produce. So by the time of harvest, they take their produce in that store, they pay a little fee, and they go find their market and sell it. That's the government contribution.
Some critics are saying that the government is ignoring where there is a lot of activities of farmers, and they are not supporting these farmers. A case in point is they are saying Western Equatoria is an agricultural belt in South Sudan, and no support has been given to farmers in that region from time immemorial. Can you help us explain this statement?
The green belt where the Western Equatoria falls and Ironstone Plateau where also part of Western Equatoria falls, those are high production areas for so many crops. But we have a limited access to support, probably because of the geography. Western Equatoria is far away from Juba, which is the center of the market. Moreover, Western Equatoria was a place and is a still place where there was the only research station in the whole of southern Sudan in those days. And that research station was founded in 1947, as early as 1947.
That's reporter John Tanza. He was speaking with Sylvester Kaka, a former consultant at South Sudan's Ministry of Agriculture. Kaka has been involved in research in the field of agriculture in Sudan and several African countries. Kenyan authorities recently indefinitely shut down the offices of 13 money transfer companies in the country after the government suspended their licenses for allegedly supporting Al-Shabaab. Anthony Wachira is the chief executive officer of the Association of Money Transfer Companies in Kenya. He tells VOA's Harun Maruf that the companies will go to court to force the government to reverse its decision.
I was a bit taken aback. In fact, that is one of the key things that I have noted and also really highlighted in the press statement, that it is not good at all for the people or entities who have been authorized and have been operating within a regulated environment through the regulator to be put together, to be grouped together with entities who are known to be either actual people who work with terrorists, Al-Shabaab or ISIS or Boko Haram or whatever it is, with, even if they are not working with them, they are perpetrators of that. I felt very bad that that means that I'm also being considered to be one of the perpetrators of the same thing.
And of course, on top of the list, it says entities suspected to be associated with Al-Shabaab. How would you respond to that accusation or to that remark?
It's a very wild allegation, and actually one would actually term it as defamation because I don't think there has been enough investigation to go around it. If whatever intelligence they use, they may not have looked at it, because some of these people have been operating for a long time. They have all the documentation done, everything, all the returns they've filed with the particular entities in the country, both the tax entity and also the regulatory entity. So in terms of all the transactions, they can easily look at it and say they are not being used at any time in any way that will mention that they may be related in any way to Al-Shabaab.
If I may ask you, how are you going to challenge this? Are you going to seek court injunction to start with?
We do intend to see whether first we can raise an injunction, court injunction, so that we can see the possibility of operating. They can even come and investigate as we are operating. In any case, this really not only affects us as operators, it affects our client, affects the entire economy of the country. So it is necessary that we need to have it back, at least with an injunction, if the government is not able to take it up.
Anthony Wachira is the chief executive officer of the Association of Money Transfer Companies in Kenya. He spoke with Harun Maruf of VOA Somali Service. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A prominent Zimbabwean journalist and pro-democracy activist snatched in broad daylight in a Harare suburb remains missing more than 2 weeks after his abduction. According to witnesses, Atai Dezimato was seized by five men while getting his hair cut March 9th and loaded into an unmarked truck. He hasn't been seen since, and authorities say they have no leads on his welfare or whereabouts. Mr. Dezimato heads the pro-democracy group Occupy Africa Unity Square that calls on President Robert Mugabe, holding power since 1987, to step down. The group takes its name from Africa Unity Square in the capital, the site of Zimbabwe's parliament and federal courts. He has pressed the demands in his writings, and 2 days before his kidnapping, he spoke at an opposition rally calling for mass protests against political and economic conditions in the Southern African nation. The United States joins the European Union, Canada, the United Kingdom, and international human rights groups in deep concern over Mr. Dezimato's disappearance. It is notable that the government of Zimbabwe officially acknowledged concern over what it called a barbaric act, and the United States prevails on the government of Zimbabwe to pursue action to resolve the case. The United States urges the Zimbabwean authorities to mobilize their full resources to locate Mr. Dezimato and investigate the circumstances surrounding his disappearance, as well as to ensure the protection of his human rights and fundamental freedoms. The United States stands with Mr. Dezimato and the people of Zimbabwe in defending the rights to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, and joins calls for Mr. Dezimato's immediate and safe return to his family and friends.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee it.